I'd like to welcome Elizabeth Stowe. She is an end-of-life care nurse, and Nancy Fay, a hospice caregiver. And the two of them are co-facilitating a community conversation on death and dying that will meet the first Monday of each month from 6 to 8 at the Whole Foods Community Room, starting on Monday the 6th of January. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. I dressed up to be on the radio.
Well, that's awfully good of you.
Well, thank you.
And this is a Whole Foods on St. Right. Francis, like right near the bacon company, not the one
yeah,
on
Yes, it's pretty much across the street from where we are now.
So you both do end-of-life care, and I wondered how each of you got into that line of work.
Well, I started because my mother was very involved in hospice care as a nurse. She worked with a doctor named Bernie Siegel out of Yale, New Haven, who wrote a book called Medicine and Miracles,
right.
I believe.
Yeah, he became a very well-known physician.
Yeah. So she was really part of the early movement in this country for nurses to get back involved in hospice care. And so I had that modeled pretty well for me. And starting in 1980, I worked in the hospital, and I worked in cardiology, and I worked in respiratory therapy. So I was in the midst a lot of critical situations and did mostly resuscitations. I will sometimes joke that this is my atonement for saving a lot of people who might not have wanted to be saved, is to have a different experience, a different quality of experience for them that they chose at their end of life. So I bring some of those skills with me, and some are completely different skills. You know, when you're working with someone who's just been hit by a bus, you do what's called like heroic medicine. You're doing whatever intervention might possibly help that person live. But when you're involved in a palliative care, your question is always, will this make my patient more comfortable? Will this make the whole situation calmer, more possible for them to keep their dignity, their integrity as a person?
And you're working, of course, with the whole family, not just the person.
Oh, yes, working with the whole family. Usually there's a hospice-trained palliative care physician. I'm working under the direction of a hospice-trained nurse. So it's not as if you're out there on your own. There's a whole support that's coming together to help this person, this family, their situation, their chosen family, to make an exit on their own terms. So it's very gratifying, because when I was in the hospital, I used to say, gee, I love doing patient care. I wish I could do more direct care. And so this is very fulfilling. I would say that hospice is my joy. I love doing the care. It's wonderful.
Elizabeth, how did you choose this one?
Well, oddly enough, it was similar. In the 80s, I was working with a doctor delivering babies. And at the same time, my maternal grandmother was dying. And I had been in the doc's office that day, and I went to visit my grandmom that night. And I was watching her. She was actively dying. And I was watching her, and I was actually overwhelmed with watching the process that she was in and going back to the process of birth that I was witness to numerous times. The breathing processes, the transition phases. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so much like giving birth, but we're going in a different direction. And that just was so powerful to me, to see that connection and the similar sort of emotional vibration that was there in the room with my grandmom was what I felt when children were born.
It's funny because you think of it as the opposite. You think of it as joy and sorrow.
I know, but if you actually tune in, well, for myself, when I tune in to really feel that feeling, to me, I call it spirit. And spirit is spirit. And I have my sense is that we as humans put a particular overlay on that as far as we're losing someone that we love. And Nancy and I were just talking about Nelson Mandela, and they have a whole different concept of, you know, celebration to his life. And
because of a different concept of
Death. Yeah. So that's how I got into it. I went back and I continued with the babies, and I became very fascinated with the process of death as well. And I started, making my way into working with hospice, and at that time it was similar. It was just the beginning of the hospice movement and that sort of caring for people that were passing. And the focus at that point in time was at home. Let's do this at home.
I think it's almost impossible to talk about hospice in this country without acknowledging what a difference the AIDS HIV crisis made in terms of rethinking a dying process, demanding different terms, change in the way we look at. Suddenly you have a whole lot of people who know that they're facing a terminal illness and saying, don't just put me in a corner. There's something more I can do here. And so there is a huge debt that we owe, I think, to that group of people in terms of teaching us what we can offer them. So they really opened up a discussion and changed so many of the ways things were done. Saying we must have better care. We must do things differently.
Is hospice mostly done in people's homes?
It can be in home. I think it's in home, it's in hospital, it's in nursing facilities.
In Santa Fe, we don't have a freestanding hospice where people can go, but I know that there is an interest in doing that at some point, and there's been some fundraising with that. I don't know when we'll see that, but one of the tragedies is that some people, when it comes down to it, you say, where would you go to die? And they don't know where they'd be welcome, where they would go. The freestanding hospices that I know of, the early ones were, in San Francisco and in New York, for people who had nowhere to go. No one was willing to take them in at that point. A great deal of the work that I've done has been in people's homes or in some kind of assisted nursing facility where we, myself and others, would come in and provide those last weeks or days of care. But I think most people, if you ask them, would probably think that a hospice person comes to your home. That's probably how it is for most people.
I think a lot of people do think that.
Yeah.
And that's what both of you do to some extent.
Yeah.
Right.
And as you point out, this always involves the family or the close friends of that person.
Now, Nancy, you said a few minutes ago that you were sort of half-jokingly atoning for working in emergency rooms and all the people who you saved or participated in saving who might not have wanted to be saved. And this whole question of whether you want to be saved, how much of a choice you have in your own death. Some of that people write down in living wills and so on, and some of it they have to kind of figure out as they're going along. What is that process like?
Well, you can have documents drawn up. I'm not the lawyer, so I won't attempt to tell you exactly what. But there can be pretty simple declarations where you state your intentions and you can name a proxy person who you give medical power of attorney if you become unable to speak or communicate clearly. And that's one of the reasons it's so helpful to talk about some of these things before you're pretty much running out of time to communicate your thoughts. And to take our choices back. For some people, they get a lot of notice that, that they have a slowly moving illness, a tumor that's growing. There can be many circumstances. So some people may enter hospice fairly early, depending on what they and their doctors determine. Often, however, I certainly have had the experience of being called in when someone is very much in the active process of dying. And at those points, you really hope that they have communicated with their family or loved ones what it is that they want.
What are some of the different choices that have to be made around that time?
What quality of interventions might be made? For instance, people, when they're dying, start to refuse, when they're actively dying, will start to refuse food and water, and they may or may not choose to have a certain level of pain medication, depending on what they're dying from. Not all deaths are painful. I know that's one of the myths that we kind of want to bust, is death doesn't need to be tragic, painful, neurotic, or it doesn't need to be any of those things. And there's a lot we can do to cushion that landing and make it really a very different kind of experience for a lot of people.
Well, I think the conversation is one thing that helps that. I mean, that was one reason why I was inspired to start this conversation, was because there were numerous times that I had gone into families. And you said something a little earlier when you were talking about the AIDS crisis and people not wanting to be set aside or put to the back. And I've seen so many times when families, I will come to assess someone for the hospice and the person will be actively dying and the family does not want me to use the word death or dying. And I've been there and literally the person has died in about 10 minutes of my arriving.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And the creation of chaos that happens after that, because he, she has not made any plans, has not had any discussion, has not, the family hasn't even, you know, approached the subject, is difficult. And also that sort of sense of, you know, most people know when they're dying. They know it. They don't have to say anything. And it's kind of disrespectful in my eyes that our doctors don't approach it that way. Families don't want to talk about it. And in my experience, when it is spoken about, when plans have been set and your ducks are in a row, as it were, there's a greater ease amongst all family, and the person is in the midst of, you know, they're not the elephant sitting in the middle of the room.
Now, I've read a number of articles recently by physicians or about physicians and the physician's own choices during the dying process. And basically, physicians, much more than other people, decide not to have heroic care at the end of their lives, according to these articles that I read, because they know what it's like, and it can be awful. And there were people who were written about in these things that said, you know, I've got a year to live, I'm going to make it as good a year as I can. I find it strange to hear that doctors are at odds with hospice nurses about talking about death, because they do know it, don't they?
Yes, they do. But it's also in our medical society, our culture, death is a failure as far as our medicine is concerned. And thus we do a lot of different things at the end of life to try to maintain that life. When actually you're right, it's detrimental, it can be extremely painful, and it goes against, I mean, all of us are going to die. That is a fact of the matter of being alive. It's just so kind of silly.
It's pretty basic.
It's pretty silly to think that that's not going to happen.
Right.
And it's painful. It is painful in many, many ways, on many different levels, to not acknowledge that when someone's sitting in front of you and that's what's going on.
There's a story that I'm remembering that Bernie Siegel told in his book about, he had a patient and he told this person, you have a terminal illness, it seems likely that you'll die in the next 6 months. And the patient said, well, what can I do? And he said, well, I think you should pray. And the patient said, well, can you teach me how to pray? And at that point, according to Bernie, he realized that his job was not done, that he had a lot more to do for his patients, a lot more he had to find ways to help them with approaching these moments. I'm not implying that we would teach someone how to pray, but just to say that there's a lot more to the job than saying, well, looks like you're leaving, see ya.
Yeah. Right, or let's try one more round of chemotherapy or whatever.
Or expensive tests that we have very little expectation will really yield results that make a difference.
I think there's something that I'd just like to say here. I mean, I feel like I don't want to be, you know, a physician basher, or no. I want, you know, there's good work out there. Docs are doing great things and helping people in a lot of ways. But I think this is not necessarily, I mean, this is in the realm of medicine, but it also is in the realm of our culture. It's very difficult for us to let go of things, to... As I was driving over, I was thinking about, well, you know, how many different ways can you look at death? And is it just physical body? Is it our egoic selves, our selves that someone is speaking something to us about, something that we could shift and change, and we're not, like, ready to do that? Can we die into certain aspects of ourselves? How do we, you know, I was just looking at all these different ways that death is actually in our lives. And I think it's very difficult to sit with someone and tell them that their life is coming to an end. It's hard for me at times to sit and think about it myself, because, you know, this is a grand place. We experience this in so many different ways. It's fabulous. It's wonderful. It can be painful. I mean, our bodies experience all of this that's around us. And in general, I don't think many of us are willing to hop off the bus at any time.
We're talking to Elizabeth Stowe and Nancy Fay about a community conversation on death and dying, which is happening on Mondays starting in the new year. I wonder what it's like for each of you to go in to families and to meet people. They're meeting you for the first time. It's the end of life. You don't know them. You don't know what they were like before they were sick. You are a stranger in the family system. There's a lot that you have to negotiate, and each situation's going to be different.
Absolutely.
That's right. You don't know what's, you know, you turn the doorknob and you walk into a whole milieu of things that are happening. And for myself, I think you have to sort of, it's kind of like taking an invisible but visible role. You have to be present but not overbearing. And you meet these people at a most intimate time. Someone once said, I keep a stone in my pocket and I fill that stone with whatever I think I know, and I set that stone outside before I open the door and step into someone's home.
Interesting.
Because you can't go in there with a lot of business going on, because that's not going to work. And believe me, I've had my experiences with it. And this is one particular job that I have had that has taught me more than anything in my whole life. As far as, you know, what I think I know, it's powerful. It's a powerful position to be in.
I love the idea of leaving everything you know outside the door, because, of course, you know so much. And you go in armed with, or not armed, that's a military metaphor, but you go in with a kind of, I mean, at best, perhaps, emptiness, but it takes a long time to cultivate that and not come in with all your own baggage.
I think of it as, you know, you bring your servant's heart, in a way.
Mm.
And in a truest sense, a good servant doesn't show up without their own tools. So yes, there are tools that we bring, you know, a knowledge of how to implement the doctor's orders, how to be present yet not dominate a space, all those things. And there's a great humility that comes with it. I think you really touched on that, of you have to be willing to let go of pretty much most of the templates that you have about how things should happen, and be willing to meet that person and their people and their dogs or whatever. Absolutely. And keep asking the question, how can I help now?
Mm-hmm.
What can I do to make this better? Maybe it's go in the kitchen and make soup, make sure that they're getting the medications they need, paying attention on a multitude of levels to what's the next useful thing that can be done. It's an honor.
It is an honor.
Yeah.
It's an honor, and it's absolutely remarkable time. Yeah, if you go in there and you think you know it all, your ass gets kicked really fast. And it's not necessarily, this is the same sort of thing as babies being born. This, you're dealing with whatever people want to call it, consciousness, spirit, there's a lot of names for it.
Do you find that it makes any difference in the patients and their families what their spiritual or religious beliefs are. In other words, if somebody believes in life after death, does it really help?
There are some ramifications of belief. Yeah, I've seen people approach death that don't really, well, they don't really know. And, I mean, none of us ever really know, to be honest. But I've seen people that approach it, and there's something that they have, some inner knowing or strength or closeness to that consciousness that actually assists them in a much gentler way than someone that wouldn't have that closeness. There might be more fear in someone. I don't know. But there is definitely something apparent when someone has a closeness to that consciousness. Or
I would also say that most of the caregivers that I know have a lot of respect for anybody's beliefs, traditions, systems. Mm-hmm. You become a bit of a chameleon in terms of if friends are coming by to say the rosary, you get an extra chair so you can put it at the bedside and they can have a friend or a family member there saying the rosary with them. Or if they're following some other tradition, whatever that is, in this town, there's certainly a great diversity of ways that people might follow. The most wonderful non-neurotic death I've ever been allowed to attend was a man who was a scientist who did not subscribe to a particular religion but was a very bright and extraordinarily kind and loving man. And when he died, he was smiling. And the
you
smile...
You wrote a beautiful piece about that. Yeah. It was amazing. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a fabulous experience for me in that you can read about certain things, academically know about them, but when you have a direct experience, you know, there's an alchemy that begins to happen. You go, that's really possible. Like mm-hmm. you were referencing how immediately after the death of Mandela, how people were, they were dancing, they were singing, they were saying how grateful they were that he had been with them so long. And yet as a Westerner, my first thought is, oh, how sad, we've lost him.
You know, I have to say, when somebody like Martin Luther King is shot down, it's one thing, but when somebody's, whatever he was, 95 years old, you think, thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Go be happy wherever you're going next, if there is a next.
Yeah. But how different that makes everything, you know, so that at least those of us standing on the shore aren't clinging and trying to drag someone back whose body clearly can't be in that body anymore. That sometimes, you know, if it's a really young person, someone we're very, very fond of, we may experience it, a tragic loss. That's definitely a possibility. There may be sadness.
I think there's sadness no matter what. It's just, I mean, for example, when somebody, and I wanted to talk to you about this, when somebody commits suicide, the sadness, it doesn't go away.
It's very hard.
Profound. It goes on and on for years. People are conflicted.
Oh, I have direct experience with that. So yeah. It's very hard. So trying to find, you know, simply to ask the question in this conversation of what is a good death? Yeah. What could a good death be? And I think each person might have, you know, a piece of the puzzle in terms of what that would mean for them. For some people, it's knowing that they've made sure that their children will be okay, or they've finished their book. They've done some big external project, or they've made sure that they know that their husband, their wife, their person knows how profoundly they love them. You know, these are big tasks that we need to do. Mm-hmm. For other people, it could be the crucial element is knowing that they will not have physical pain. They will not have unbearable pain. And again, certain kinds of deaths have a lot more possible physical pain involved.
Yeah.
But we do have, we have skills, and as you were saying, we have some wonderful, fabulous doctors here mm-hmm. who actually are very skilled in palliative care mm-hmm. and are very dedicated to getting pain management that works for the patients. It is possible to do. We are no longer doing those late scenes in terms of endearment where the person's yelling for pain meds. We're not doing that.
We're talking to Nancy Fay and Elizabeth Stowe about end-of-life issues, and I wanted to ask you about the difference between when we were talking about suicide, but there's assisted suicide, which is very, very different. And, I mean, one is the choice to end your life when you really have a choice. The other is you're dying. What is the way that you choose to die?
This brings me to what we call the community conversation on death and dying. I mean, we had a marvelous conversation at the month of November when a young woman came and actually opened my eyeballs tremendously about this particular issue. I had a lot of my own judgments, beliefs about this, and she, in her wonderful way, was extraordinary in just explaining, coming from a place of being a terminal or having a terminal illness, and why that choice would be something she would consider. And all of the wonderful things that go along with that, just the fact that in making that choice, the conversations that are set up amongst your family members in explaining why you want to do this, helping all of those closures come to fore. Yeah, it really changed my mind.
Explain more what you're talking about.
Physician-assisted suicide, I guess, or there's another word for it. What do you know, Nancy?
She was using the words right to die.
The right to die, right.
And so she was a young woman with a terminal illness. Is it harder when it's a young person to see your way through that person's choice as opposed to if they're 93 years old?
I don't know.
It challenged me.
The whole thing is challenging to me. And this is something, as far as going back to the context of what we're doing here, this is the reason that I wanted to have this evening. Because I think to be able to sit down, such as we're doing here, and just converse about the issue of death, dying, and all the many ramifications that are available and are out there, and situations and things that are available for people to take in and become more knowledgeable about, is helpful.
One of the things that Elizabeth and I talked about early on was wanting to simply provide a space for conversation, not to present ourselves as some sort of experts that we're going to tell people what they should do or how they should feel, but to basically welcome their curiosity, welcome their quality of not knowing, their questions, because who is an expert on something that we can't see in a lot of ways? We all have the same level of expertise inside us. But how important it is to hold that open space for discussion and not to get caught up in dogma or any of those little traps, but to say, you know, we're here to ask questions together, to formulate our questions, our feelings, our uncertainties, and share them and see what happens. And this particular conversation where I was there in November, I was amazed at what happened for me in the midst of that conversation with this young woman who looked fine to me, but who had, you know, had a diagnosis, had had surgery, had chemo, had done everything, and had reached her own place with what she wanted from her life and from her death. And yet it really did throw me off my equilibrium to have someone significantly younger than me say, this is the choice I want to make.
Well, the question is when? And who makes that question? I mean, people sometimes when they're ready to make it for themselves are no longer able to do so.
Yes.
And then to what extent can they get their children or families or spouses or whatever involved in that question? And those are thorny issues, which I think it's really important to talk about when you
are
young and healthy. I mean, maybe not on your wedding night, but
maybe not. Maybe not. And that leads to so many other questions. As you know, good questions tend to open a door, and then there's more questions behind it. Mm-hmm. But for instance, say I'm that person, and I know that I'm needing to make those choices. If I'm going to designate someone, maybe I don't have a husband, a wife, a spouse that's legally recognized. Maybe my nearest relatives, who might hold that power legally, are 2,000 miles away. How do I deal with that? How do I make sure that my wishes aren't violated? How do I set that up? And a lot of that has to do with starting the discussion as soon as you can and letting people know what you think, putting it in writing. There are documents that are legally binding that you can use now. So that's part of it. And then there's all the feeling parts of it. As Elizabeth was saying, the spirit part of things that needs to be addressed too, of if there's fear, what kind of support do you want? Is it religious? Is it friendly? Is it entirely solitary? It may be for some people. I'm not trying to make somebody fit some sort of pattern, but just hold that space open for discussion. And that's really the goal that we have, is that we're planning to offer speakers on some nights to start the discussion, possibly readings from, you know, memoirs or other kinds of writing. I think Elizabeth had short clips from a documentary or two, different things for different nights. We made a whole list of people that we're going to invite to start discussions. But then what we hope will happen is, you know, this organic process of people bringing their questions, maybe not their answers, but at least their questions to start with.
And everybody is invited. It's a community conversation on death and dying. It's meeting the first Monday of each month from 6 to 8 in the Whole Foods community room on St. Francis, on the corner of St. Francis and Cordova, not the one on the bigger one on Cerrillos. And it's an open space for everybody to show up, facilitated by Nancy Faye and Elizabeth Stowe, whom we've been talking to. Thank you so much for bringing all of this interesting and important discussion to the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you
thank
for
you,
bringing
Mary Charlotte,
it
very much.
To everyone.